The Tom Woods Show, episode 1269.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I thought today I would take a little time to say a few things about the financial crisis of 2008. And the reason is somebody showed me an episode recently of, I guess, Sam Harris's podcast, and I can't off the top of my head even remember who the guest was, but somebody was telling me that the guest was saying things like, nobody forced these banks to make bad loans. And I thought, oh gosh, are we really at that level? 10 years later, we're still making lame arguments like that. So I thought, given that it is 10 years since the financial crisis, and some people are talking about it for that reason, well, maybe I'll say a few more things about it. First of all, let me just start with this, that just that general point of nobody forced the banks to make bad loans. Well, I've got a bunch of episodes of this show and a whole book called Meltdown on that question. I suppose that is technically correct. Nobody came in with a machete and said to these people, you have to make bad loans. I mean, if that's the point they want to make, I guess I'll yield it to them. But I don't see how that helps us going into the future, because I could just as easily say, yeah, I left my keys on the hood of my BMW and somebody stole it. Now, nobody forced that guy to steal it, and I could just go on to be outraged about the fact that the guy stole it. Now, I should be outraged. Just because the keys happen to be on the hood doesn't mean somebody has the right to steal it, obviously. But at the same time, if I'm trying to think about what's going to prevent people from stealing more cars in the future, well, I mean, I do have to kind of look at my own behavior first, right? I mean, I could say, well, the way to move forward is to just lecture the world on the need for respect for private property. Now, that's all well and good, but that's not going to stop thieves. Maybe the thing that stops thieves is you don't leave your keys on the hood. So my point there is not so much that it would be a perfect analogy with the financial crisis, but rather that the idea that I wouldn't want to look at the question of under what conditions are people more likely to do bad things? And instead, just think if I morally hector them, that nobody forced you to do that bad thing. Okay, but you created the environment in which that bad thing is much, much more likely to happen. How about you fix that problem? Then we'll fix all the bad people in the world. But, I mean, which one requires less effort? Just not implementing bad policies, or the moral reformation of the entire world? You see my point? So likewise, with my car example, I could just try to morally reform all the thieves, or I could just use some common sense. So that's why when I heard that line, and I'll grant you, I have not had time to listen to that podcast episode, but I heard that line, I thought, oh, come on, you got to be kidding me. So anyway, I've been thinking a lot about this sort of stuff recently because Meltdown is coming out in a 10th anniversary edition in paperback. Actually, there has not been a paperback edition. It's very funny. The book sold very, very well, but the hardcover sold so well that the publisher never really felt particularly compelled to issue a paperback. They just kept printing up more hardcover copies, which is fine. But it's less expensive for you folks, the readers, if we have a paperback edition. So a paperback edition will be coming out. There is an audiobook edition. It's not read by me, but there is an audiobook. And if you join Audible, if you're joining for the first time, they give you a free audiobook when you join. And even if you decide to quit, they still let you keep the free audiobook. So you can quit within 30 days and not owe them anything and still keep the free audiobook. But you probably like the service. I like Audible a lot myself. But anyway, you can do that through tomwoodsaudio.com. It'll take you right to that page. Anyway, as I say, I just wrote an introduction to what will be the 10th anniversary edition of that book. And that, by the way, this is the second book I've had a 10th anniversary edition come out. My book, The Church and the Market, came out in a 10th anniversary edition in 2015, and that had a whole new chapter as well as a new introduction. So it's, and plus the cover is beautiful. It's so much better than the original cover. But when your books start having anniversaries, that's how you know you're getting up there. That's how you know. So anyway, these are the thoughts I've been having about it. I mean, you probably heard me talk about the book itself and the circumstances under which I came to write it. So I won't say much about that, but just that At that time, I thought Ron Paul ought to write a book on the financial crisis because I thought he had the credibility, he had the track record of warning about it, he had the knowledge, he had the stature as a public figure. I mean, you put all those factors together, that is a dynamite combination. I thought this was a definite, and I could not interest him in it. He just didn't want to do it. He said, I've already said everything I have to say about it. I've already written all the articles I have to write and given all the speeches I have to give. And I thought, oh my gosh, here he is, Ron Paul, and he doesn't see right in front of his face that that means he's got 75% of the book written already. So I tried in vain to persuade him of this, and he just wasn't going for it. So I said, what if I wrote such a book? Would you contribute the foreword? And I think I had guilted him enough by that point into doing that, that I was able to get a big old yes to that. So it has a foreword by Ron Paul. That was very nice. So as I say, it did very, very well. It's my second best-selling book out of my dozen. And I wrote it for obvious reasons, right? We all knew what was happening at the time of the financial crisis, that everybody was going to say the same darn predictable thing, that this is what goes and happens when we leave you people to do whatever you want in this Wild West laissez-faire economy. I don't know what to say about that. If you look at the Code of Federal Regulations, it does not look like a Wild West laissez-faire economy to me, and especially the banking system. So I thought there's got to be some other perspective that has to get out there. It can't just be the Krugman perspective. Also, I felt like conservatives were not really doing such a good job. They did not know what to do with the financial crisis. That is to say, because they don't talk about the Federal Reserve, really. I mean, what conservative was writing about the Federal Reserve before the financial crisis? And I don't mean to, you know, maybe have a mild criticism of one little aspect of it, but really look at it in its fundamentals. Basically, nobody. And because the Fed was off the table, it meant that they were left to grope around for some lame explanation for the financial crisis. So they would say, the trigger for the financial crisis was the Community Reinvestment Act, you know, from like 10 or 11 years earlier. Because there was, you could see clearly some pressure being placed on financial institutions to extend loans to people who would not ordinarily have qualified. But it wasn't, I don't know, I think the role of the Community Reinvestment Act has been exaggerated a bit, but that's really all they had. And also, they weren't looking that hard because the Federal Housing Administration, the Federal Reserve itself, I mean, it was Department of Housing and Urban Development, there were pressures being placed on banks from all different angles. It was really, really astonishing. And then also this point about nobody was forcing the banks to make bad loans. Yeah, that's true. I show in the book why there were certain factors that tended to give them the incentive to make bad loans. And one of them was the existence of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were, they're called government-supported enterprises, but they're the worst of the public-private partnership, basically. And what they would do is they provided a secondary market for mortgages. A bank could sell a mortgage to them, which means that if the bank keeps the mortgage on its books, then the bank collects the monthly mortgage payment from the homeowner, and then they earn money from the interest payment, the interest portion of that payment. But if they sell the mortgage, then let's say Fannie Mae pays them some amount, and in exchange, Fannie Mae gets the right to collect the mortgage payments and the interest. And given that you have this institution that's standing there ready to buy these mortgages, and that everybody knows, as it turns out, those people who thought they knew about this were in fact correct, that they're backstopped by the Federal Treasury if anything should go wrong. So they're just, they have this voracious appetite for these mortgages. So the banks, of course, the banks will just make mortgage loans and then just sell them to Fannie Mae. Why wouldn't they do that? So you may say, no, nobody was forcing them to do it, but what a completely uninteresting point to make. Yeah, I get nobody's forcing them to do it. The point is the logic of the system means it's more likely that they're going to do it. How about we look at that? So anyway, my point is that I felt like the conservative movement was not doing a good job because as a movement in the mainstream of American political life, they were not critics of the Fed or even mentioners of the Fed. And I thought, somebody's got to mention the Fed over here because the Federal Reserve monetary policy, I believe, played a pretty substantial role in the crisis. And that's really what so much of the book wound up being about. And also, I wanted to show that it's not just generic free market economists who have been good on this. It's specifically the Austrian school of economics, the school of Mises, Hayek, Rothbard. Those are the economists who understood what was happening and understand what's going on right now. So then one thing that in Meltdown I don't get into as much, I did get into it more in my book Rollback, and you can certainly read about it in my book The Deregulation Boogeyman. That one you can get for free at regulationmyths.com, is that I don't really get what people are talking about when they say deregulation caused the financial crisis, because most of the so-called deregulation occurred many years earlier. And it just seems altogether unrelated to the events of the financial crisis. I mean, allowing banks to adjust the interest rates offered on savings accounts or allowing branch banking seem benign and irrelevant at the same time. And I mean, you'd think branch banking would promote more stability rather than less. And indeed, that's precisely the effect it had in Canada. So then you get some people who talk about the so-called repeal of Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall being a regulatory act dating back to 1933, and that this is the pertinent act of deregulation. But in fact, Glass-Steagall was only partially repealed, and the part that was repealed also had nothing to do with the financial crisis. Carnegie Mellon's Alan Meltzer said in 2009, quote, "I would challenge anybody to point to something important that was deregulated during the last 8 years. The last major financial deregulation was the 1999 act that President Clinton signed, removing the Glass-Steagall provisions separating commercial and investment banking. No other country in the world separates commercial and investment banking, and none of them have problems on that account. Nor have we had problems on that account," unquote. Bill Woolsey, another economist, says, "Glass-Steagall is a red herring. I think it is brought up because it is the only bit of deregulation that seems slightly relevant, and some people cannot accept that misregulation and entrepreneurial error rather than deregulation was the key source of the problem," unquote. So this partial repeal of Glass-Steagall simply meant that the same holding company could control both a commercial bank and an investment bank. But did the crisis of 2008 actually involve institutions that had both kinds of banking? The answer is so obvious that even the Washington Post had to concede the irrelevance of Glass-Steagall to the crisis. And here I want to share with you an extended quotation from the Washington Post. "Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch, three institutions at the heart of the crisis, were pure investment banks that had never crossed the old line into commercial banking. The same goes for Goldman Sachs, another favorite villain of the left. The infamous AIG, an insurance firm. New Century Financial, a real estate investment trust. No Glass-Steagall there. Two of the biggest banks that went under, Wachovia and Washington Mutual, got into trouble the old-fashioned way, largely by making risky loans to homeowners. Bank of America nearly met the same fate, not because it had bought an investment bank, but because it had bought Countrywide Financial, a vanilla variety mortgage lender. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo, two large banks with big investment banking arms, resisted taking government capital and arguably could have weathered the crisis without it," unquote. So what all this deregulation talk seeks to avoid is the simple fact that banks made bad loans. In other words, banks did a bad job at something they had always been allowed to do. There is no repealed regulation that would have changed this. Now, why banks would have made bad loans in a cluster and all at once is part of the subject of my book, Meltdown. And I've also got some links about the financial crisis, links to episodes that I've done that I'll put on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1269. Well, certainly we can say that the superstitious reverence for regulators is misplaced. And Bob Higgs, who's been a guest on here a few times, puts it this way. Had they been given even greater powers, budgets, and staffs, what enchantment would have transformed the regulators into smart, dogged champions of the public interest rather than the time-serving drones and co-conspirators with the regulated firms that they have always been, unquote. And incidentally, even if regulators were truly wise and all-knowing, it is naive and uncomprehending to think once the Federal Reserve has created the conditions for an artificial economic boom, that there's some way to regulate our way out of the ensuing bust. Then meanwhile, we're told that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke saved the United States from Great Depression 2.0 by his wise and unprecedented interventions. We've all heard this. David Stockman is withering on this. He, of course, you know, served as director of the Office of Management and Budget under Ronald Reagan. And he's just been brutal and unforgiving in his response to this claim. David Stockman says, "No public official has ever committed an economic folly greater than the horrific misdeed of Ben S. Bernanke when he provided the Great Depression 2.0 cover story for the lunatic outbreak of central bank money printing. It destroyed the last vestige of Wall Street discipline in a financialized economy that had already been bloated and deformed by two decades of Greenspan-era bubble finance." And Stockman goes on, "Now the speculative furies would be unleashed like never before. In one great fell swoop, the above monetary explosion destroyed price discovery and financial responsibility entirely, turning Wall Street into a pure casino and enabling windfalls of massive proportion and unspeakable inequity to be showered on a tiny slice of the population." Bernanke does not even bother to prove that a Great Depression was imminent, nor does he show what would have actually been a short-lived and healthy liquidation of financial speculation on Wall Street would have spilled over to the real economy and taken Main Street into the drink," unquote. So what really was happening to the economy and what should Bernanke have done? That's what I'm about to get to, but I first want to remind you about a really neat and easy way to be able to get a lot of the reading done that you want to do super quickly and efficiently. We all want to read more than we could ever possibly get to, but Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most important elements, so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes all on your phone. So with Blinkist, you can expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. I like to listen to Blinkist when I'm out driving, as I'm always taking the kids hither and yon. And I have access to a massive Blinkist library, from timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich to current bestsellers like Skin in the Game. 5 million people are using Blinkist to expand their minds 15 minutes at a time. You should get started today. Because right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to start your free trial today. Blinkist.com/woods. All right, so what was actually happening to the economy was something like this. Following the dot-com bust in the late 1990s, around 2000, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan thought it was a good idea to stimulate the economy. By doing what? Well, lowering interest rates, of course. This set the economy on an unsustainable path. We've heard this also many times. Consumers and investors alike were misled into making what turned out to be unwise financial decisions. In fact, household debt doubled in less than 7 years, growing at the absurd rate of 10.2% per year, a trend that obviously could not continue in perpetuity. So by 2008, this process had begun to slow down and even reverse itself. What was happening was that on a one-time basis, elective spending on such non-necessities as vacations, home renovations, and the like was being brought down to a level that made sense in terms of people's wages and salaries. Now, this didn't mean that the economy was spiraling down into a black hole and Fed interventions were necessary to rescue it. It meant that those sectors of the economy that had developed and expanded only because of cheap credit from the Fed and that couldn't actually be sustained by people's real earnings were shrinking, and that resources were being shifted into lines of production that would be sustainable over the long term. This is how an economy heals itself after its central bank pumps it with the equivalent of energy drinks nonstop for nearly 7 years. But the myth of Great Depression 2.0 helped propel the push for the bailouts. "There's no time to investigate the details, citizen. We must shovel this money to irresponsible firms as quickly as possible." And so then we were told, "We have to bail out such and such institution in order to save Main Street." Oh yeah, really? Let's take as an example the insurance firm AIG, where so much of our attention was focused early in the crisis. The problem there involved something called credit default swaps, CDS. But almost none of AIG's busted CDS liabilities were held by Main Street banks. They were held by about a dozen large institutions, and these dozen institutions alone would have taken the hit. And they could have absorbed that hit because they held about $20 trillion in assets and were facing a mere $60 billion, or possibly $80 billion, in losses. So about the equivalent of less than a year's worth of executive bonuses was what they were faced with losing. Well, AIG wound up getting its bailout anyway. There just wasn't time for us to discuss the details, you see. We peons needed to know our place and trust our wise overlords. Well, lo and behold, in April 2009, former AIG CEO Maurice Greenberg told Congress that his firm should simply have been allowed to go through the bankruptcy process, that the economic effects would have been trivial, and that the public would thereby have been spared the bailout. How about that? The bailouts, by the way, that followed the outbreak of the financial crisis represented the culmination of, rather than a break from, previous policy. A prejudice toward bailing out major players had been implicitly built into the economic strategy known as the wealth effect that the Fed had been pursuing ever since Alan Greenspan's tenure. The idea was, we're going to use monetary policy to push stock prices up and keep them up. And so when Americans see their stock portfolios rising, they're going to grow more confident, and this will make them go out and borrow and spend more. And that in turn would stimulate economic activity and make the GDP figures look strong, which would in turn reflect well on the Fed. Well, this is just Keynesian demand management. It's fake. It's like running the economy on monster drinks. But where were the free market economists criticizing this? As far as I can see, only Austrian school economists had anything to say about it. Now, note well, what happens in this arrangement if stock prices start to come down? What does the logic of the wealth effect demand in terms of government or Fed policy in that situation? Anything that threatens to bring the stock market down, even when the stock market is vastly overvalued and needs to come down, must be reversed. Because otherwise, the Fed's policy based on the wealth effect will be undermined. So the bailout mentality was therefore built into this way of thinking. So you get the idea? We're ginning up the economy to keep stock prices up, and that's the center of the whole thing. Because the high stock prices give people confidence, which makes them go out and borrow and spend, and that's how they think they need to make the economy go. So little confidence do they have in a market economy. So if anything is threatening to bring the stock market down, at all costs that has to be stopped. Then meanwhile, the Dodd-Frank Act, or the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010, which was the centerpiece of so-called financial reform, appears to have had zero positive results. Compliance costs, as we've seen on this show, crushed small banks and apparently retarded the opening of new ones. The number of new banks being created each year declined sharply from 100 down to about 3. And since the kind of community banks that were hardest hit by the compliance costs of Dodd-Frank, since this is where small businesses generally got their credit, this one piece of regulation, by making credit more costly and less abundant, goes a long way toward accounting for the sluggishness of the economic recovery. So I'm going to leave things there. That's enough stuff to chew on. Definitely check out Meltdown. I'll let you know when that paperback 10th anniversary edition is out. But in the meantime, check out my ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman. It is free, and it covers a lot of this material for you. So you can grab that over at regulationmyths.com, and you also make me very happy by grabbing that. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.